Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
A look at the mind games our brains play, whether we're aware of them or not. This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer, and today on the show, a look at how the mind perceives time and music. And later on the show, a rock and roll rave up from the Irish performer Imelda May and her band. But first, the neuroscientist David Eagleman has made a career out of studying the unconscious mind. His latest book, It Incognito, The Secret Lives of the Brain, explores what our brain is really doing while we're performing everyday tasks, and how it responds in ways that we might not expect or even approve of. In a moment, we'll hear about his study of time perception in drummers, which was inspired by a conversation with the musician Brian Eno. But first, David, let me welcome you to Soundcheck.
Thanks. Great to be here.
So, in this book, you suggest that our brains mostly run on autopilot. I mean, we think of ourselves as thinking constantly, you know, comments, internal comments, and, you know, we're constantly have a stream of ideas going between our ears. But the suggestion that this is just the tip of the iceberg, what the heck is going on underneath all of that?
Well, the brain is the most complicated device we've ever found in the universe, and it's made up of hundreds of millions of pieces and parts, and these are always operating at full tilt under the hood of your conscious awareness. So anything you do, if you, you know, let's say you go to the piano and you play out a little ditty on the piano, it feels effortless to you, like your fingers are just doing something, but that is underpinned by a lightning storm of neural activity. And the thing is that all that activity is totally invisible to you. And as you reach your arms down into this, what you come to find out is that it's not just playing the piano, it's recognizing a friend's face or falling in love or any of the things that we do in our daily life. We don't actually have access to all of the activity that underpins that.
Do we want that access? Is it useful to have this kind of filter?
We definitely would not want that kind of access. Essentially, the conscious mind is like the CEO of a company who gets to do the long-term vision but doesn't really understand all the mechanics of what's happening in the company below, nor would he or she want to, because when the CEO starts messing with those things, it makes everything run more poorly. So, for example, if you're a good piano player and you start paying attention to where your fingers are going, you're dead, right? In a recital, what you have to do is just zen out, right, and let your unconscious machinery do its thing. That's what being in the zone is about.
Well, it was interesting when you went right to the piano image straight away. That, you know, if you walk over to the piano and play like a little riff, it's effortless. Well, I don't play the piano, so for me that would not be effortless.
So let's
there
say,
would be a lot more stuff in the conscious part of my brain.
That's precisely right. So it turns out your conscious only gets involved when you really desire to make a change to the underlying machinery. So let's say you decide you want to become a pianist. You go, you find a teacher. The teacher says, okay, look, hold your hands up higher like this, hit these notes and so on. There's a lot of conscious effort there. You're having to determine the trajectory of your brain company. And what happens over time as you practice is you're actually burning into the circuitry of the brain how to play piano. Mm-hmm. And all this unconscious machinery learns it up. What you get is speed and efficiency, but what you lose is conscious access to how you're doing it. I mean, a good piano player or guitar player or anybody can't tell you exactly how they're doing it.
And the same thing with composers, who very often, you know, this is one of the great frustrations of the interviewer, is like, so where did that piece come from? I don't know.
Yeah, it's funny. We spend a lot of our time layering on these conscious narratives about why we've done stuff, and almost entirely these are just confabulations. I mean, I'm glad you didn't ask me the question of how did I come to write this book, because I would have to say, I don't really know. I can tell a story about how I came to do it.
But whether that's truly how it came about, who knows?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, here's an example of that. Just take when you have an idea, when you say, oh, I just thought of something. It wasn't actually you that thought of it, right? Your brain under the hood has been working on that for hours or days. And It serves up something to the conscious mind, and you say, hey, I'm a genius. I just thought of something. But it wasn't really you that thought of it in the first place.
The book is called Incognito, The Secret Lives of the Brain by David Eagleman, who is a neuroscientist based at the Laboratory for Perception and Action and the Initiative on Neuroscience and Law at Baylor College of Medicine in Texas. And most of the book is about, you know, kind of quotidian day-to-day things that we do, the things that we do as a biological organism, the things we do as individuals. Music is sort of peripheral in the book, but music is a really interesting thing to talk about in terms of neuroscience because of the way it affects the brain, because it affects every part of the brain.
Well, that's right. It affects the brain. And, you know, one of the things that I've been interested in is how the brain produces music in the first place and how music can be tied into other areas of the brain. So just as an example of that, one of the things I study in my laboratory is called synesthesia. Mm-hmm. And it's a condition where people have a blending of the senses. So somebody with synesthesia might hear music and it causes them physically to see colors or shapes or movement. And it's not that they're being artistic or metaphorical or they're on drugs. It's that they're actually physically experiencing this because the auditory parts of their brain are cross-talking with visual parts of their brain, for example. And so it turns out that many famous composers and musicians have synesthesia. They enjoy this. And
you say it's kind of a cross-talk. Is it a pathology? Is this something that's wrong with the brain?
Actually, this is interesting. It's not called a disorder because it's just an alternative way that brains can go. So it used to be thought this was very rare, but we now know that about 4% of the population has synesthesia, so it's quite common. And yeah, there's no disadvantage to having it. In fact, it might be only advantageous. You know, a lot of people leverage their synesthesia into their greatest works of art. For example, the painter Kandinsky would crank up his phonograph and stand in front of his canvas and paint what he was experiencing.
Mm-hmm.
And other people, music composers, would sort of do it the other way around, where they would say, look, I want to have these colors. I want to paint the visible world with sound. That quotation is actually from Olivier Messiaen, a composer who set out to paint the world by, you know, and if you look in his diary, he talks about here's a blue-orange cascade of chords.
Hmm.
Of course, for each synesthete, it's idiosyncratic.
Right.
So his particular relationships between a sound and a color would be different than someone else's.
I've asked, you know, Keith Jarrett, the jazz pianist, and Robert Fripp, the English guitarist, you know, both of whom have synesthesia, what C major is for them. And for Keith Jarrett, it's blue. No, for Keith Jarrett, it's red. For Fripp, it's blue. C major is blue. So when you hear Robert Fripp playing this guitar music, it's not for him just music. He's in a key and he's seeing some kind of color to go with it. And this is the phenomenon that we call synesthesia. The guitarist Robert Fripp and a piece called Evening Star that he did with Brian Eno, with whom you, David Eagleman, have worked, and we'll talk about that in a couple of minutes. But, you know, here's an example of a musician who has synesthesia, the kind of permeable border, I guess, in the parts of the brain that are supposed to look at visual things and acoustic phenomena.
That's right. In most brains, those are kept separate, but in the synesthetic brain, those mixed together. And there are many different forms of musical synesthesia that I study. So for some people, a note, a pitch, will cause a particular color. For others, it's chords, it's intervals between notes that triggers the experience. For others, it's the key that one is in. And for others, it's the instrument timbre itself has different colors. So we're able to study this sort of thing. And some people have a very rich synesthesia where it's all of these things interacting. And they have a rich experience when they listen to that piece of music.
What about, is there something similar at work with the way that we perceive time? I mean, this is a big part of what you've worked on and written about over the years. And, of course, what is music without time? I mean, music unfolds over time. It's one of the definitions of what music is.
That's right. Yeah, well, it turns out one of the things that we've discovered over the last 11 years or so is that time really is a construction of the brain. It's not that we're just passively tracking the flow of the river of time. It's that we're actively constructing that. And what that means is there are all sorts of illusions of time. We can make you think in the laboratory that something lasted longer or shorter than it actually did, or that something happened before something else, or that a beat is running faster or slower. And it also turns out that some people are just sort of better at timing than others. Something I've just been thinking about recently is, you know, this old philosophical conundrum of when I look at the color red and have this internal experience, how do I know that it's your internal experience of red, right? It might be what you would call blue inside of my head. I've been thinking about that in relation to time. What is 2 seconds like to me, and what is 2 seconds like to you? What happens in both of these cases is that we agree in the outside world to call this red and to call this duration 2 seconds, but it might feel very different inside people's heads. And so that got me interested in looking at, can people experience time very differently from individual to individual?
Mm-hmm.
So I was talking with Brian Eno at dinner one night, and he just mentioned a story about Larry Mullen, the drummer of U2, and he said that he had the click track going,
right?
And Mullen,
the click track, for folks who are not musicians, have not worked in a recording studio, that is simply what it sounds. It's a thing that goes click, 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 and it allows everybody to sync up all the different layers of music that are going to be mixed into the final song. So
precisely. So this is for studio recording, and you know, the musicians come in at different times. So this is the electronic metronome that they hear on their individual headphones,
right?
So Larry Mullen's playing along on the drums. He says, you know what, Brian? Something's off with the click track with the other instruments. It's off by just a little bit. And Brian says, no, it's for sure on. I've checked it on the computer. And Larry says, nope, it's not. So they get in an argument about it. So finally, Brian gets frustrated with him and says, okay, fine. Just tell me what I'll hand adjust it for you, even though the computer says that it's at zero. It's exactly where it's supposed to be. So Mullen says, okay, a little this way, no, a little back, a little forward. So Eno frustratedly does it.
He's humoring the drummer.
Humoring the drummer.
So they again.
So they do that, and they finish the session, and Mullen leaves the studio, and then Eno sees that he'd accidentally put something in the code that put things off by just a few milliseconds.
6 milliseconds, right?
Yep.
6 hundredths of a second.
That's 6 thousandths of a second.
Six thousandths of a second.
Yeah.
And Larry Mullen heard that.
Yes, and he realized that Mullen had adjusted the dial exactly to cancel that out. Right, so when he told me that story, I said, it can't be. Nobody's got time perception that good. But so we started discussing about that. Obviously, drummers are people who you would expect, either by training or by selection going into the profession, are quite good at it.
Well, U2's drummer, certainly very good at it. And Larry Mullen Jr., you hear him in the background with this U2 song called Elevation. And the study is something I want to follow up on in a moment. But first, here is Larry Mullen Jr. and the rest of U2. Elevation is the song from the album All That You Can't Leave Behind. And David, this this was the album, this was the session that Brian Eno was producing when he had this experience with Larry Mullen Jr., noticing that the click track was off by 6/1000ths of a second. So when we come back, let's talk about what you and Brian Eno cooked up as a way of what? Kind of
experiment, turning this into an experiment.
To see just how we experience, how we perceive time. So that's coming up in just a moment. And then coming up later, we'll hear a live performance from the Irish rockabilly singer Imelda May and her band. This is Soundcheck. This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. More now with neuroscientist David Eagleman. He's the author of the New York Times bestseller Incognito, The Secret Lives of the Brain. He was also the subject of a recent profile in The New Yorker, which, among other things, detailed his research into how drummers perceive time. Eagleman's study, as he was telling us a moment ago, was inspired by none other than the musician and producer Brian Eno, one of whose earlier records, Taking Tiger Mountain, you're hearing in the background. So, David, first of all, did you think going into this that drummers, that musicians in general, would have a keener sense of time than, quote-unquote, lay people?
Oh, yes. I strongly suspected that. We had noticed that in my laboratory. You know, we'd run lots of subjects through experiments, and we noticed that video gamers and musicians just had a better time sense than the average bear. And it's no surprise in either case, musicians, if you had a really terrible sense, you probably wouldn't make it very far.
Right.
And video gamers do a lot of practice with this, as do musicians. Yeah, they've got an extraordinary sense of time. And of course, in something like a symphony orchestra, they have to be moving ahead or behind of the beat because of the distance that sound has to travel out to the audience. And I noticed these guys are really good.
Mm-hmm.
And the general thing in science, if you want to study something, you go out and you find the best people at it. If you want to understand how brains represent time, you want to find people who are really killers at it.
So you and Eno decided to work with drummers. The question being, do drummers have different brains from the rest of us? And Eno's quip of an answer was, everyone who's ever worked in a band is sure that they do. How is this something you can work on? Is this something that you, a mental muscle that you build up?
It's not actually clear to us yet the degree to which you can practice it up, probably to some degree, and then the rest is just natural talent. But so here's what I decided to do. After Brian had told me that story about Larry Mullen, I thought, my gosh, I've got to go study this. And of course, Brian's got this terrific studio and he's got the hookup with these drummers. So what I did is I flew out to London to his studio and I brought with me my equipment. I brought a portable EEG device that's electroencephalography. We have this new one that is small and portable, which is a new phenomenon. And I had to get through the TSA that way, which wasn't easy. It looks like a strange device that you strap to people's heads, which it is. And so I got there, and we got a whole bunch of drummers together that day at the studio, and I just ran through testing them one after another. Will Champion was there from Coldplay and many other very talented drummers. And so I ran them through this whole battery of tests that test sort of 7 different aspects of time perception, being able to compare durations, being able to detect whether 2 rhythms are the same, being able to align a sound and a flash, things like this. And I measured what was going on in their brains. It's not as sophisticated technology as, for example, neuroimaging, things mm-hmm. like fMRI. But it is, portable, and I was able to do that. And so what we're doing right now in the laboratory is running this through a bunch of control subjects who are not musicians. And then we already know that there's a big behavioral difference, by which I mean drummers can keep a rhythm and match a sight and a sound and detect differences between rhythms. They can do that much better than control subjects. And now what we're finalizing is figuring out what is different in the brain.
So you see the effect. Now you're trying to see what's happening in the brain that might allow for that effect to take place.
Precisely.
if you, I mean, was one of the tests kind of suggesting a rhythm, a beat per minute to the drummers and seeing if they could kind of sink into that?
You know, we didn't do that one officially. We just sort of sat around and did that unofficially while we were having snacks with everybody. And yeah, many of the drummers there are really terrific at saying, you know, give us 100 beats per minute. They're really good at doing that.
And so you mentioned Will Champion of Coldplay. Somebody in the room says 78 beats per minute, and he's...
Yeah. Yeah, he can do that. It almost makes me wonder if it's a type of synesthesia, by which I mean if different beats per minute feel like something to a professional. Yeah.
So the click track that we were just hearing was at 78 beats per minute. If you ask a normal person who is not, you know, the drummer from Coldplay or the drummer from U2, how close would we get to 78 BPM beats per minute?
Oh, I don't know. Probably not close at all.
Yeah.
I haven't sat around over snacks with control subjects and asked them to do that, but maybe that's what I'll do next.
All right. Well, let me tell you a story about drummers. There's this South Indian-born, longtime American-based musician named Shankar. Not Ravi Shankar. This is L. Shankar, violinist, who is known for performing with only the very best drummers. And the story of how he picks his drummers is this. He'll sit in the studio with them and start playing. And, you know, they'll set up, like, you know, the rhythm, usually based on a traditional South Indian rhythm, at which point Shankar gets up and leaves the room for up to 20 minutes and comes back. And the deal is, if you're still hitting the one where you're supposed to be 20 minutes later, you've got the gig. And this is some of the music. This is why when you hear Shankar, he's always playing with, like, the greatest drummers from India or Europe or America or wherever. Shankar playing the violin sort of in the background there, but that is some amazing drumming, David Eagleman. Even allowing for some exaggeration in this story, maybe he doesn't leave for 20 minutes, but still, to kind of step away, come back, and expect the drummer to still be in rhythm, you know, exactly keeping that sense of time, what does that say about Shankar's perception of time and the drummer's? You know, what does that say about the brain as a timekeeper?
You know, it's actually a really interesting challenge that he gave to those drummers, because presumably they're nervous about the audition, and that makes it even harder. I'm just setting up some experiments now with the Houston Symphony Orchestra, because one of the things, I've been having a lot of discussions with them about this, one of the things on their mind, of course, is that when you're really nervous, when it's a big performance, you're so terrible at keeping time. Most people speed up. A couple people do the opposite. They play more slowly than they're supposed to. But if you ask them afterwards, they'll think they were right on, and in fact, they weren't. They were way off, and we all know this sort of experience and this sort of thing. So it turns out keeping a rhythm's really hard because we don't, you know, we're not metronomes on the inside. We are essentially sloppy metronomes that are pushed around by things like fear and temperature and fatigue and all sorts of issues like that. So it's a real, you've got to be keeping all the noise down in the brain to keep your metronome from getting influenced by these other things.
And it's not just, I mean, one of the points you make in the book is that we don't just have a single timekeeper. We have multiple timekeepers going at the same time.
Exactly. You know, this is one of the big lessons about time in the brain is that we don't have a central clock. Time is weird. It's not like any of the other senses. We actually call it metasensory because, you know, I can show you a flash of light and then you can compare the duration of that to a beep in your ear, and you can say which one was longer or shorter, which means it's not about just the vision or the hearing. You can compare across senses with ease. Now, that might make you think, oh, well, it must be that we have a central clock, but it turns out none of the data support that. Instead, it seems like it's made up of all kinds of clocks at all different scales. Yeah, it's an unsolved problem.
Well, we're speaking with David Eagleman, the author of the New York Times bestseller Incognito, The Secret Lives of the Brain. Your previous book called Some, a series of marvelous short, sometimes very, very short stories about the afterlife. You worked with Brian Eno on that project as well. He did some music for some readings of those.
That's right. Brian Eno contacted me out of the blue and said, I love your book so much that I have been inspired to write 12 new pieces of music for this book, and would you perform this with me at the Sydney Opera House? So I said yes, and I went out there, and you know, that was the first time I had ever met him, and it's just been so terrific. He's not only is he, of course, a terrific musician, but he's also very smart and scientific-minded. And so we've been putting together other collaborations. I mean, we did the drummer study after that, and we're talking about other things in the future now.
And now you're going to be working with Max Richter, the German composer who for many years was based in England, on an opera version of Some.
That's exactly right. So, Max Richter was commissioned by the Royal Opera House in London to write a new opera, and he and the director independently read Some and called each other and said, I've got the topic for the opera. And so then they contacted me, and so that's going to happen in 2012.
In May of 2012 at the Royal Opera House, you're hearing some of Max Richter's music in the background, and he'll be setting the opera to the words of David Eagleman from his previous book, Some. The current book is Incognito, The Secret Lives of the Brain. And David, it's fascinating stuff, and thank you so much for coming in on Soundcheck today.
Thanks for having me.
Coming up next, retro rocker Imelda May and her band bring their big rockabilly sound from Dublin to our New York studio.